Policy Office working on opioid overdose prevention. He conducts research and provides community and professional technical assistance on opioid use disorder treatment and opioid overdose interventions. Two areas of his current work is evaluating an HHS SAMHSA-funded community-based overdose prevention intervention and working with the Washington Department of Health on developing opioid overdose surveillance systems. In thinking about this morning, I listened to one of his recent podcasts that he did with the Seattle Times in an interview, and he said this: none of us are perfect. We need to embrace the gray of life. And he closed with this simple phrase: I believe there is fundamental value in keeping people alive. Please welcome Dr. Banta Green.
I didn't realize I was a radical, but there you go. I'm guessing you are too. All right. I could have called this lots of things. I called it the opioid epidemic. What you count and how you count it counts. Very, very proud of that. So I have no conflicts of interest to report. I have not and do not take funding from pharmaceutical companies or any for-profit companies. I'm speaking on my own behalf and not the University of Washington's. And I actually mention that about conflicts of interest because I proactively say that to media when I talk with them. And they're like, oh, I never thought to ask that. I'm like, oh, my God. Are you kidding me? So there you go. So what is my current funding? I work in the Washington State Department of Health. I'm subcontracted to one of the CDC grants. Thank you very much. Thank you. I never get to say thank you to the person who had the money. So two things that I'm really excited to be working on with that project. One is an epidemiological piece, which is about trying to better track opioid overdoses with EMS data, and I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Another piece I'm also very excited about, and my State Department of Health listened to my idea on this, so it made me excited, which is we actually hired a full-time public health nurse to do professional and lay technical assistance around treating opioid use disorder with treatment medications, which you will hear is my theme, is that is public health. So I'm very excited about that work, and actually we're going to be really expanding that with Cures Act funding this year across our whole state, dramatically upscaling that. We also have funding, as mentioned, a large SAMHSA grant that is ostensibly around overdose prevention. These are very large grants. Our state got $5 million for 5 years. And the grants were actually kind of written in terms of, at least the way they read, was buy a bunch of naloxone and give it to cops. So we hired 4 syringe exchange managers around the state and gave them naloxone and asked them to lead community capacity building processes, starting with overdose prevention, bringing people into the conversation with naloxone. But I've trained thousands of people in overdose, including many police officers. And all of them at the end of the training are like, well, that's great. We just kept the person alive for an hour. Then what? So then we use that to lead into a conversation about the underlying health condition driving these overdoses, which to some degree is pain, to a lot of degree is addiction, and a lot of overlap across those, and how communities can respond to that. Then I have a lot of funding from our state, not a lot. I have some funding from our state substance abuse agency, which is a lot to do around epidemiology. We do a lot of trying to do our best to extract meaningful data out of meaningful information out of a whole range of secondary data. For instance, I'm a really weird person. I really like police evidence testing because I really like quantitative chemistry. So we use those data, which are data you can get with a couple month lag to find out what drugs are on the street, which has been very informative for us. And I'm wrapping up one grant with NIDA, which is a clinical trial of opioid overdose prevention in an ER. Little hint, if you're ever involved in a clinical trial, don't do your first one in a public health ER. It's slightly difficult. I will also say the need is phenomenally high. We have a 6% all-cause annual mortality rate in that population. And then also a tiny bit of support also goes to being the representative for Seattle for the drug epidemiology workgroup. I was actually hired in 01 to take over the Seattle role in this drug epidemiology workgroup, which was then in 21 cities, has since been sort of restricted back to about 10. And I was hired actually on methamphetamine. Methamphetamine was this new drug, and it wasn't just in urban areas. Oh my God, it's hitting rural areas as well. We don't have any way to track drug trends in rural areas. At the same time, we were starting to see the emergence of pharmaceutical opiates as well. So those actually ended up intersecting. And then lastly, because I didn't learn my lesson from my first clinical trial, I'm doing a clinical trial with funding from the Arnold Foundation, which is people releasing from prison who have opiate use disorder, doing treatment decision making and treatment navigation with them. So those are the current projects I'm working on, which you'll see alluded to as I go on. So thinking about the influence of where we sit, I've seen this federally at the state and local level. So, you know, we're always asked, here's a problem, give us some data and tell us what to do. And I think what's really important is, and what I've seen is, where we sit has such profound impact on how we see an issue, how we think about it, what are our measurement approaches, how do we analyze the data, and what's the nature of the responses. And that's really what I'm going to talk about today. So who do we have around us really informs how we think about things. Who do we go to at the next cubicle to say, I've got this problem, what do you think I should do about it? So, you know, we often have standardized measures, and guess what? They're convenient, and they're replicable, and maybe even mandated, but they're not always adequate. You know, as someone who reviews a lot of epidemiology articles, as many of you do, you know, what data do you have? What's your question? Did your analysis actually allow you to answer the question? Usually the answer is no. Usually in most papers I see, people are overextending using inappropriate data for their analyses. That's what we have available to us. We still persist with some of those analyses. And so that's a real challenge I think we all face, because we want to do something, we think there's meaning, and we don't always get adequate sort of clinical or other subject matter expertise involved early enough in our analyses to really make sure we're doing something that is on point and is ultimately valid. I actually just read a paper on a way out here that I will not name that was all about the impact of retention of buprenorphine treatment with medications, but all they did was it was a longitudinal analysis, but they only looked at what medication was prescribed the day they started. That's all they had for the measure. I was absolutely stunned. It gave me no insight into how we can give advice to current programs that are trying to determine, do you kick people out of your program if they're using benzodiazepines illicitly? Does it have a negative impact on treatment retention? Does it have an impact on mortality? We think it does, but we don't have good longitudinal data to actually prove it. And then we tend towards interventions that really sit in our regulatory wheelhouse, and I'll talk a lot about opiates. In terms of opiates in Washington State, our State Department of Health regulates medicine. So we came at it from that perspective for a long time, and we did a lot of good, but we also missed a lot of opportunities. And then the way we do things, how many of us have called a colleague in another state and said, okay, I just got told I had to do this, I know you do it, how do I do it? We do it all the time. And too often we sort of plug and play without sort of sitting back and thinking about why, and is this really going to help us really get at the crux of what we're doing? So specifically, you know, in terms of what we're looking at and grappling with the opioid issue, and again, thinking about it at all these different levels, so we typically rely on things like national surveys around misuse, and I'll talk about that in a minute, morbidity and mortality, thinking about consequences. And then what I'm not going to talk too much about in terms of my slides, but I'm going to touch on it now, are prescription drug monitoring program data. I've been very actively involved with this at our state. I think there's a lot of potential good in those data, but I think they're also drastically misused. As someone who's actually my doctor's in health services research, the decision to write a prescription, how many of us go to the doctor and say, I want this prescription at this dosage and this many of them and give them to me? Now, nowadays, people may do that. But in the olden days, we didn't do that, right? It's not, I think, too often the PDMP data are looked at somehow a measure of patient demand. But they're also about physician practice, they're about reimbursement, they're about health systems rules. They're really, really challenging data to look at. You know, on the one hand, can you find the outliers? Sure, you can find the outliers. You can find outliers in prescribing. You also don't know if they're the best or the worst prescribers. That's a slight challenge. You can look at outliers in terms of patient receipt of meds. Then you have a real challenge. Okay, they're an outlier. Clearly something's wrong. Are you going to fire them or are you going to engage with them? Those are two very, very different options with very likely different mortality consequences. And then you've got things like, well, this percent of this county got this medication, and this county's 50% higher than that county, therefore let's target that county. The issue with opiates is it's high everywhere. As you said, it's 1 in 5 with adults get an opiate prescription each year. It's about 1 in 10 adolescents. So if one county's at 12% of adolescents getting an opiate prescription, the other county's at 8% getting an opiate prescription, am I just going to talk to the 12% county? Are they going to get all the attention? I think what's really important And I was actually very honored to get to, I got to say to the Surgeon General, I got to talk to Dr. Murthy in the fall and say, if I were Surgeon General for a day, which thankfully he got a little longer than that, writing, a little longer than that. And he also did release the first Surgeon General's report on opiates, so that's a little something to pull off in your time. But what I said to him is, you know, if I had the nation's ear for a moment, it would actually be to ask, why do we take stuff? Why do we take stuff to deal with physical and emotional distress? Whether it's alcohol, marijuana, opiates, fentanyl, why do we do that? And why has that changed so dramatically? And we can talk about incentives and healthcare systems and diet chocolate cake and all of those things, but that's sort of the fundamental question to me is, why do we take so much stuff? So this is old school. I'm going back to old school, and I was joking. I'm going to leave. This is the speech where I show you my lessons learned over my 15 years, and hopefully there's a nugget or two of goodness. This is the old school stuff. This is a report I wrote in 2003 on prescription opioid use, pain management, and drug abuse in King County and Washington State. And this is death data, and these are counts, and the top line going up there is methadone. My actual first visit when I started being a drug epidemiologist, I sat down with a medical examiner, and I'd first looked at the data, and there were all these methadone deaths. I was completely confused, because I'd done my social work internship in a methadone clinic 6-7 years before, and I'm like, methadone's protective of overdose. I don't understand what's going on. Who are these people? Where are they getting these drugs from? Why are they using them? He said, I don't know. I said, well, don't you think we should find out? He said, please, go ahead. So he's still there. We've been working together. He's great. He didn't mean, like, please go ahead and go away. He meant, please go ahead, let me know what you need. But if you could do the analysis, that would help. So that's what we did. So, you know, here's these data. If you remember that Excel automatic format for charts long ago, they date you. So this is a few years later, I showed up at a meeting not quite this big, but to my surprise, it was about 300 people. I got invited to a tribal community, a community meeting that I, of course, thought was going to be the professionals in the community, and turned out it was, but not the ones I thought. And I get there, and it's hundreds of people in this gorgeous longhouse, ages 1 to 81. And I got up with my ridiculous pie charts. I don't really use pie charts. But I got up there with my bar charts and my line charts and all that. And they basically said, nice charts, but what do we do? I was like, oh, that's brutal. So I remember my social work training, and I said, what do you think? And grandma said, you know, I get 300 oxys a month, but the pharmacy is next door to the grocery store. Maybe I should just get a week's worth of meds at a time instead of a month's worth. I'm like, oh, sounds like an interesting approach. But it really was a big kick in the pants and really moved me into doing more intervention-based research, more advocacy work as well, and trying to do better epidemiology. So I think it's pretty clear, as Dr. Ori just said, that our existing measures are clearly inadequate to describe not just what's happening, but really understanding it and what do we do about it. So I'm going to try to give some insights from various projects I've worked on. So this draws on my personal clinical background around talking to people, asking questions, and as this gentleman is doing in this picture, listening. And then actually providing people tools. And people like the joke, that's a really stupid question, Caleb. So I'm a big fan of simple questions. I'm a big fan of simple questions asked to the right people. They can yield profound, profound insights, and I hope that I can share some of those with you. And then I also learned from this community epidemiology work group report process that we have, really diverse perspective. This is just our latest one here. I just put it up as an example around the types of people. So we have academics. We facilitate these meetings and pull the data together. Johnny, the guy from Ryder Childhood Center, he's the homeless substance abuse counselor. He rides his bike all over the city and talks to homeless youth about their drug use. Adult drug court folks, behavioral health folks at the county, public health folks, syringe exchange, infectious disease folks, our state recovery helpline, the people that get the calls every day. They're the ones who call me and say, I'm hearing something out of Eastern Washington, I'm hearing about heroin, and I'm hearing about young people calling in desperation because they want to commit suicide because they're afraid to go through withdrawal from young adults. We talk to the state patrol. I talk a lot to our state toxicology lab. I have a very, very old, rusty immunology degree, but I at least kind of know what questions to ask. And the state toxicology lab has incredibly rich data. They're not perfect. They're another angle on things that are really important. Medical examiner's office, the high-intensity drug trafficking area, which is an ONDCP initiative. A lot of FDEA people come as well. And then our state poison center as well. They're very interesting for sort of incident new issues. Try to explain to people they're not good prevalence data, but they can be interesting incidence data. But some of the great things that we get in that conversation is we get Johnny, the guy on the bicycle riding around town, sitting next to the DEA intel chief, both talking about crack and both saying opposite things because they're on opposite ends of this. And you just get such richer insights into what's going on when you can have those discussions. And not just have those discussions once, but know that you've created those relationships so whenever you have a question, you can call people up. The question I used to ask all the time, and I finally learned the answer, is always the same, which is, why is something going on with drugs? I used to always, when I was doing ecstasy-related work a few years ago, talking to people in the community, and now the same thing applies to fentanyl. Why is this happening, or why is there less fentanyl here or there? It always comes down to profit. Right? It's always about because somebody's making money. That's always the answer. So you just have to think in terms of economics and behavioral economics. So again, just to reiterate this, how do you make sense of this really complicated problem? So asking people, clients, patients, staff, what's going on? What actions do they want to take? What do they need? What are the knowledge and resources they need? We were talking about with emergency room physicians. They were begging for some sort of rules or excuse to not have to prescribe opiates. Because otherwise their customer satisfaction ratings were going to tank. So they were really excited when Washington State came in with rules back in 2007 from labor and industry where pilot educational rules that were codified in law in 2012 around pain and opiate usage. That really helped physicians to have to say, look at the wall. Here's a set of guidelines. They're in the waiting room. This is standard care of what we do. This is how we do and don't use opiates. And we need to give it back to folks so they can actually use it. Again, either for patients, consumers, whatever you want to call them, citizens, so they can do their own self-advocacy, but also clinicians and health department folks. And then really trying to get it back to policymakers, and I'll talk a bit about that in a moment. So this one, no offense to people who work on the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, but this question drives me nuts. I think it drove me nuts in about 2004. The question is something like, respondents are asked to report only non-medical use of these drugs, defined as use without a prescription of the individual's own or simply for the experience or feeling the drugs caused. So your brains are cramping. Think about the cognitive load of any respondent, including a younger respondent or a less educated person. That's a hard question to absorb. And even if a person did completely comprehend that question, what does the answer mean? I don't know what that means. I don't know what to do with that result. So again, sort of low-hanging fruit. Very happy to reach out to the State Department of Health, and I think my colleagues are out there who are fabulous to work with. And we wrote a question. It was basically in the past month, and how many days did you use a painkiller to get high? That's what I wanted to know about. So we asked that question. And the results are pretty interesting. So on the left side here, you can see the first year we asked this question. These are high school sophomores. This is 10th graders. So 10% of high school sophomores said they used prescription opiates to get high in the past month. That's really high acuity. That's 3 kids per classroom. And coincident to this, temporally parallel, we saw a fairly steady decline in some of the stronger opiate prescriptions, particularly oxycodone, methadone, morphine. Not hydrocodone came later in terms of the decline. But this decline roughly parallels what we saw in terms of opioid prescribing. And I like to say this is a positive intended consequence of reining in opiate prescriptions. There are negative consequences that we'll talk about as well, but there are some positive intended consequences. And this is really surprising to me. This is just simple association. If the proportion of those who said they'd ever use heroin was only 3% if you had not used prescription opiates to get high in the last month. It was a quarter of high school sophomores who, if they'd used prescription opiates, they were saying they'd also use heroin. That's an incredibly strong association among high school sophomores. What I think is important, and I realize actually I probably should use more charts, sorry. But what's interesting is, and you'll see this in some of these data, is that as this decline in prescription opiate misuse has gone down, that's lovely, but you'll see in some of our later data this aging but still very young cohort of folks. And given that many of them have opiate use disorder, which is a chronic lifelong condition, we're going to have to be thinking about how do we provide care to keep people functional, productive, happy, and alive for 50 or 60 years. That's pretty massive system change that we're going to have to do. And I actually didn't include these slides. I apologize. You can see them somewhat in the national data. Washington's ahead of the country because we reined in opiate prescriptions earlier. But the effect is that this is my epidemiology. So this is prescription opiates in Washington State. Heroin is completely made up for it, and our overall opiate level is completely flat. It's completely unchanged, even as we have significant changes in both. So a lot of our measures, our metrics are, oh, did you see a decline in prescription opiate deaths? Yes. Who cares? Honestly, who cares? A person's dead. I don't think anybody really cares what substance is in them. So I'm going to talk a bit about this. These data are really exciting to me. As I said, this is my social worker coming out. But we do a lot of work with syringe exchange clients and doing surveys with them. Again, I like to talk to people. And unlike every human subject's review, people who have used drugs actually are perfectly happy to talk about their drug use. Like, it's, you know, oh my God, you're going to talk about their drug use, you're going to freak out. No, you're going to freak out as the human subjects reviewer. The person's just fine. Just letting you know. If you're respectful and listen. Now in our articles, you see we say convenience sample. They're really attempted censuses. Censi? Oh, I don't know my Latin. You probably all do. It's an attempted census of trying to get everybody at exchange. We do these every other year generally. It's an anonymous paper survey. It's a quick street intercept survey. It's like 7 minutes. It's super quick. People are getting a little piece of chocolate as a thank you. We added a question, as Johnny was telling me, riding his bike around, I'm seeing all these young people going from pills to heroin. I don't know what's going on. It's crazy. It's blowing up. I'm trying to talk like Johnny. We wrote a question, before you began using heroin, were you hooked on prescription type opiates? That was our question. This was the first, I believe, to my knowledge, the first paper that ever reported this in a quantifiable way. So what we saw back in 2009 was 39% of heroin users said they were hooked on prescription opiates first. They were more likely to be young. They were really looking at quite a different cohort of folks. So a pretty substantial minority were reporting using prescription opiates first. As a side note, the challenge of doing these types of data is this was either the third or fourth journal we had to send this to. People want to know the psychometrics of my question. That's one question. Anyway, so it was challenging to try to get some of this work out, but to me it was still worthwhile to gather these data, and it's become much more standardized to use this type of question. And the validity of this question really came out of working with addiction medicine doctors and doing some pilot testing of the question with people at Syringe Exchange. We had a follow-up where we looked at this several years later. This paper is really looking, trying to describe more of this young cohort of folks. We had a higher proportion, over 50%, who said that they were using, who were hooked on prescription opiates first. And we're looking at those associations and really just now trying to define this younger cohort. And what we're seeing in this instance, that these younger folks are reusing syringes much more often, they're sharing syringes much more often, and they're hooked on prescription type opiates at much higher rates. We know that. So there's this important young cohort. So then we took this question statewide in 2015. Again, this was almost a spur-of-the-moment decision. We had actually hosted a large statewide meeting around prescription opiates with public health, law enforcement, and treatment folks. There were so many people there. We filled to 400 in like a couple of weeks. We had to stop. We had to block out the meeting, and we'd do another one in Eastern Washington. Everybody wanted their local data, right? Everybody wants their data, including for syringe exchange. And we were blessed to have a lot of syringe exchange access in Washington State. So we launched this pretty quickly. This is 18 syringe exchanges at the time. This was 18 of the 21 syringe exchanges in Washington State. These syringe exchanges distributed 85% of the syringes. And what you can see here is simply, so for instance, I probably can't really point in three places at once. That bright green near Thurston, that's one syringe exchange. That's Olympia. That's our capital. And those dots are where people slept the night before. People came from five different counties to come to that syringe exchange. You have neighboring counties that refuse to allow syringe exchanges, won't allow health officers to say the word syringe exchange out loud for threat of their job. So you can see this survey, and I'm going to mention we're about to do this. We're going to launch this again in about a week and a half. We are going to go really much harder into Eastern Washington and try to get a lot more out of that side of the state, and I'll show you why in a minute. So here's my favorite question. Before you began using heroin, were you hooked on prescription-type opiates? So it's 57% statewide. The blue shading here is showing those who responded yes, and you can see the age distribution, and you see this big, young cohort of folks. We just keep seeing this, and we're seeing this statewide. So what else can you get from this kind of quick and dirty street intercept survey? Pretty interesting stuff and pretty useful stuff for local folks. So we can ask just about syringe use practices, and we can get the estimated number of syringes used per year, you know, the number of syringes distributed in the area. If we can do a basic calculation at the state level and the local level of the number of active injectors. These are really conservative. This is probably 100% under, or 50%, 100% undercount. But it gives you something you can actually hang your hat on. We really don't have much else other than that. So we can see that we have about 25,000 active injectors in Washington State who are using syringe exchanges based on these estimates. We know there's more syringes being used than are just coming out of these syringe exchanges. We actually have some decent pharmacy-based access, but it gives us some kind of quantifiable number. The other thing I thought was really exciting, this is the main question I wanted on this survey was this one, because I'm also a treatment guy, and I know that treatment is both medicine and public health and good for people. We just asked people, would you be interested in getting help to stop or reduce your use? We didn't ask them if they want treatment, because that is a very, very loaded term for most people. The answer is almost always it depends. So we asked them if you'd like the behavioral piece, would you like help stopping or reducing your use? And the point here is you have two-thirds of people saying very or somewhat. Most people want to not be using. And that's obvious if you've ever talked to a heroin user. It's not obvious if you've ever talked to a legislator. Right? These are people making stupid decisions because they're bad people. I'm summarizing, I'm paraphrasing. Not a lot, though. I'm not paraphrasing a lot. We have legislators talking in very moralistic terms about this, including at the state and federal level. So the point is, I think this is a really profound, I know it's a pie chart, I lied to you, I do use pie charts, because I use them for legislators. So this pie chart, this pie chart is saying most people want help using, a proportion don't know. They're my favorite people as a social worker. I love talking I don't know people. But really importantly, 24% said no. And that is where that came from. What are you going to do about that 24%? Are you going to write them off? Or are you going to work really, really hard to engage with them? That's really important. I apologize, this is hideous. So this is just looking at variants across Washington State and really this push. I have a couple of students we're going to make a move to Eastern Washington for a couple of weeks, which is awesome, and they should move out there. But you'll see really big differences, and I can't point, but you can look at this. So you have all sites in the first column, the entire state, King County, which is the Seattle metro area, and Eastern Washington. So I'm going to focus on King and Eastern because they're the most different. And I love heterogeneity. So what you see here for heroin is 91% in King County reported using heroin, 63% in Eastern Washington. Different for methamphetamine. Methamphetamine, 59% in the Seattle area, 75% in Eastern Washington. Huge, huge, huge methamphetamine issues going on in Eastern Washington. And we've actually seen profound, massive increases in methamphetamine overdoses in King County. Just in my area, Seattle, 2 million people, we've had about 20 methamphetamine-involved overdoses per year for a decade. Throughout the mid-2000s till a couple years ago, we just ran the data. We're now up to 96 last year. We've seen a consistent increase over the last few years. That's as cocaine went down, and now meth users are combining with heroin. So we're seeing really profound changes in M. And also, the opiate epidemic is one of polydrug use and multiple health conditions. And you can see that we do have opiate medications. In terms of drugs used, we are seeing about a third of folks are still able to get opiate medications. That's way down from where we used to be. They're much harder to access off the street. So as I said, we're doing this follow-up survey. We're bringing in more syringe exchanges. We actually had a question a few years ago that we did in Seattle about have you used fentanyl, what did it look like? Most of the time back there it was patch, a little bit of powder. We know it would be very different now. We're actually adding, from Dr. Robin Pellini, who's done work with NIDA funding, around over-amping on stimulants. So we're going to add those questions. And then we're going to add more questions around treatment interest, both for opiates. So if you're not interested in treatment, why not? And if you could get treatment readily and easily, would you take advantage of it and what types? We're going to ask the same thing for methamphetamine. And that actually comes out of one of my graduate students' work that she's just wrapping up. Right now, I signed on it, which basically was looking at people's interest in treatment engagement for heroin users and found an odds ratio of 0.5 for those who also used methamphetamine. So we need to figure out what that's about. Why do the meth users who also use heroin, why are they not interested in treatment? So sort of circling back in some ways to where we started, we talked about some of the common public health responses. Basically, I think we're all doing this. We're regulating prescribers and prescribing. We're upscheduling opioid drugs. There's a lot of rules and regs on opiate prescriptions. We're trying to do medication disposal on the primary prevention side, more on the tertiary prevention side. We're doing a lot of syringe exchange work in many places, and obviously not all places. A lot around infectious disease, surveillance and treatment, and naloxone distribution is this big thing, right? Which is ironic because when I was working in D.C. in 2012, it was all about naloxone, and naloxone's great. Naloxone should fall from the skies, but it's completely inadequate. So naloxone, if you look at the estimates out of a paper by Coffin and Sullivan, it looks like if you distribute naloxone to heroin users, you have a 6% mortality reduction. That's awesome, 6%, that's great. If you get people on agonist medications, methadone or buprenorphine, you have a 50% mortality reduction. I think we do both. But we're not really talking about the second one. We're spending a lot of attention on naloxone, and I hope we'll use that as a gateway drug into a much richer conversation. So I want to talk a little bit about Washington State's opioid response plan. We all borrow and beg and steal from each other, which is awesome. If you do borrow, beg, and steal from our response plan, please look at it really carefully. I'm going to highlight a few things I'm particularly excited about. I'll mention this work group started back in June of 08. Super focused, just like I said, on prescribing, right? Overseeing medical practice. We had a fantastic advocate in terms of Dr. Gary Franklin, a medical director for labor and industry, who was really, you know, ringing an alarm bell around people coming in for back pain, getting opiates, and dying of an overdose 6 months later. So we really focused on this prescription opiates super hard. And we have, every once in a while, a couple of us would say, addiction, addiction. And it didn't go very far for many, many years. And it's interesting, whether it's West Virginia or Washington, these data are a little bit dated, but the general ratio is about a third of people who are dying with their own opiate prescription on board. About a third is somebody else's opiate prescription, and about a third is heroin. So you can think about regulating opiate prescribing having something to do with pieces and parts of that. The challenge is when you rein in opiate prescribing and there's no longer diverted access for pharmaceuticals, and those people are opioid dependent and they have opiate use disorder, you didn't fix their opiate use disorder by getting rid of their drug supply. We all know what happened. And so people are using heroin, which is, you know, slightly more unpredictable, particularly not in the age of fentanyl. And then, you know, more recently, I would just change this equation from being one of, you know, a ratio of 1:1:1 to prescribed, you know, opiates prescribed to the person is a lot less than prescriptions not prescribed to them, heroin and fentanyl. That's now really a minority of what's going on. It was the catalyst to a lot of this, but it is now not the primary focus, and we've done a lot on that side. So really quickly, our goals, not going to shock you, trying to improve prescribing practices in terms of prevention, treating opioid dependence with medication, getting naloxone to people who use heroin. That's actually a very specific and purposeful thing. That is the only evidence we have of a population health impact is getting naloxone to heroin users. There's a nice BMJ paper from Massachusetts. We have no evidence about getting it to anybody else and it being effective. We only have evidence about getting it to heroin users. And then, of course, who doesn't love delicious data? We do. So a couple things on the prevention side. We want to raise awareness around the possible adverse effects of opiates, including overdose, but really importantly, also adding into this, reducing the stigma of opiate use disorder. So when you're seeing that patient who's really struggling and they actually say, you know, you caught me, right? Yeah, those aren't my x-rays. Yeah, you caught me. Then what are you going to do? How are you going to engage with that person so that clinician actually understands what opiate use disorder is, how to make a referral, get that person in a warm handoff to get them started in treatment, whatever they need and want, ASAP. In terms of treatment, a lot of our work now in Washington State, also some parallel work has happened and to some degree in Boston and a lot in San Francisco, is really trying to get people on these medications. As I mentioned, and I say buprenorphine, as I said, I have no pharma money, because it's the easiest thing to scale up, and it's a very effective medication. And the point is that if we stop seeing it as a treatment medication, this is this silo thing, right? Oh, substance abuse treatment, that's not public health. That's substance abuse. That's not us. But if it's 50% mortality reduction and you're doing naloxone, why aren't you also involved in the buprenorphine conversation as well? So we're doing a lot of work, not just to get buprenorphine out there, but to get it out there in a low barrier way. It's very classic. Most of my old health services research is all around treatment engagement and retention. The typical story I hear for a person getting on buprenorphine, among those who get on it, that slightly select group, right, is it took them 12 weeks to their first dose of the medication. 12 weeks. So what we're trying to do is get people started the same day. And we started 5 low-barrier Suboxone programs in Seattle in the last half year. And they're all completely overflowing, and it's complete chaos, but we have showed tremendous need. We have people showing up several hours early for drop-in appointments. If you want to get people on treatment medications, the answer is drop-in appointments. Because if you just want to get stably housed heroin users who don't use anything else, you can get them to show up at primary care. But if you want homeless people who use benzos and methamphetamine, you're going to have to do something different because they're not going to show up in your primary care setting at an appointment. It's not going to happen. And if you want to have a public health impact and you want it to be that big, you got to go after everybody. Otherwise, you're only going to have that big of a public health impact. We're also doing a lot of work, as I mentioned, in the criminal justice system. We now have several jails that are starting this. You think you mentioned working with law enforcement, working with prosecutors. Prosecutors' clients are sheriffs who run jails. And speaking of anecdote, every jail in the state has said to me exactly the same thing. Half of the people in my jail are detoxing from heroin right now. Oh, really? What sort of medications are you using? Oh, we're not using anything. They're just writhing on the floor and puking everywhere. I'm like, oh, would you like to make your job easier? We have some medications that would actually make your job easier. And then also really trying to work with syringe exchanges. As I said, to increase their capacity. In addition to the survey that we did with syringe exchange clients, we also did surveys of all the syringe exchange staff, and we cataloged what they do. What are their funding sources? What are their hours? What are the types of services they offer? And then the stat that I go back to the legislature is to say Grays Harbor out on the coast has Kurt Cobain Memorial Park. They're open 4 hours a week. They distributed 750,000 syringes last year. And we asked them if we could give them some free naloxone to distribute, and they said, we don't have any staff. We don't have any time to train people to distribute naloxone. So we really need to figure out how we can get those frontline folks engaged in this work. I'm looking at myself here. So in terms of intervening, I'm really trying to obviously want to do all the overdose education pieces, getting naloxone out to folks. Really in every which way we can. We really emphasize getting naloxone to the people most likely to have or witness an overdose, which are opioid users in our social networks. We're doing a lot of work with our SAMHSA grant that will also involve getting it to first responders. I actually just wrapped up an evaluation for the Seattle Police Department about their naloxone deployment, which was mostly focused on how do you measure this. The counts, the way that police have talked about the success is we reverse this many overdoses. What's the health impact? What is the actual acute and long-term health impact that you're having on individuals? And what we're seeing is that for bicycle officers, they're seeing a lot of these overdoses. They're coming upon them in alleys, and they're there 3 to 5 minutes before fire gets there. But if you go to patrol cars, usually fire's there first, and if they do get there, they're there 50 seconds earlier. So how do you want to deploy your resources? And it's less about that one example as opposed to a measurement model that then I can give to the state patrol, and I can say, I bet you're distributions are going to be really different, and think about those for your deployment. So just how do you get those sort of basic metrics out there? Because when I was at a meeting with DOJ and cops, I said something like, it may not be the most efficient use of resources to have police carry naloxone. You would have thought I said there was no God. Because they were so excited, and it was such great PR. Like, it may not actually be having a net positive impact. And they're like, anyway, I left. So improving these measures, I just want to touch on a few things here. Heroin versus morphine, you talked about it. I'm going to share a little bit of the work that we've done there. And this is also one of those silo things where medical examiners have a particular task that they need to make the determination, and it has to stand up not just in court, but when they talk to a family. But we have different needs as public health folks. They're not the same as forensic. Are there additional data that could be captured for public health purposes, like an estimate of heroin use, even if you don't put on a death certificate? And that came about because in 2005 we did a case series around prescription opioid overdose deaths. We wanted to understand the form and the source and the motivation of these pharmaceutical opiates. Sounds familiar for fentanyl? And what we found out is a bunch of them actually had heroin present, and it was completely obvious. Like, if you read the records, you knew whether heroin was present, but it was not in the summary data. And that's where you'll see one of the reports that we came out with is a new way to just look at that, super low-hanging fruit. EMS data, we've historically relied on naloxone administrations. The few papers that are out there around naloxone and overdose rates using EMS data are all based on naloxone administrations. And then fentanyls, the chemical analysis and scene investigations you said is really important. Just a couple quick examples. This is a paper which, honestly, you're going to need to email me because it's in a professional journal. I'm happy to send you a copy. It's very hard to find. This is with our medical examiner, our state toxicologist, and myself. Real simple way to track whether people have a heroin involved in deaths. Obviously, you have definitive metabolite 6-monoacetylmorphine. Great. That's a small minority of cases actually have that. And that was why a small minority of cases were recorded as heroin. And it's probably why, unfortunately, the CDC data are still a substantial underreport for heroin. We're probably really misclassifying some of those older heroin deaths. But if a person's morphine positive, has codeine in relatively low levels, and or the scene, circumstances, and history are consistent with injection drug use, everybody says they were a heroin user, there's heroin user at the scene, you can call it a probable heroin overdose. It's okay. And we'll take that data and we'll use it. That's what I'm talking about, low-hanging fruit, a really, really simple approach. And we've been using this for more than a dozen years now. One other thing here, this is an article that's about to come out from our EMS data. We did chart abstraction of a couple hundred cases a few years ago. And I think really importantly, just from chart abstraction, and it's very little standardized data, anybody who's worked with EMS data knows they're super cardiac focused. There's all sorts of stuff about bystander response and AED usage and other things, other interventions. It's all under the cardiac protocol. It's generally not under anything else. You can't get those data. But we were able to find out what type of opiate was involved in 80% of cases. That was pretty good. What was really striking was the clinical presentations were essentially identical for the heroin and pharmaceutical-involved overdoses, but the treatments were very different. Pharmaceutical users were much more likely to be intubated, which has, of course, a lot of follow-up sequelae and costs. And the naloxone utilization, those studies that relied on naloxone utilization as a marker of overdose are missing a lot. So we found naloxone was used in 72% of overdoses for heroin users and 51% for the pharmaceutical users. This is even though these had the same respiration rates, Glasgow coma scores, pupil size, and so on. There was differential treatment based on which drugs were suspected. And then we're using this information to inform our current CDC grant. And then just lastly, State Department of Health was seeing an uptick in fentanyl deaths in 2016. Did a really nice analysis statewide about, the demographics, co-ingestants, and so on. And then I offered to basically do an enhanced death investigation within four of the county's medical examiner's offices with which I work very closely. So we actually, thankfully, it's all due to economics, we only have about 10% right now of our opiate overdoses involve fentanyl. And it has not yet driven an overall increase in our opiate overdose rate. We went from, depending on how you count, 23 to 56. We had an increase from 2015 to 2016. So what I just want to say is we dug into, did a chart review, developed an abstraction process in King County, then sent this form off to the other counties, and they filled out and sent the data back to me. And we basically came up with this classification system first to begin with. Is it a prescription-type fentanyl, clear evidence of a pharmaceutical product, usually a patch, that may or may not be prescribed to the decedent, it's the type of opiate involved. A non-RX-type fentanyls, and that fentanyls term is actually taken from the European Monitoring Center on Drugs and Drug Abuse, EMCDDA. It's a term that they use that I like. These are non-pharmaceutical forms of fentanyl. Could be fentanyl. It could be a tablet or powder, which are not the pharmaceutical forms. It could be fentanyl plus the compound 4-AMPP, which is made in manufacturing. So you won't see 4-AMPP unless it's used in illicit manufacturing of fentanyl. So that's a marker there in toxicology. And then also non-RX fentanyl analogs such as acetylfentanyl. So that's that whole group. And then really importantly, this is a big nebulous piece, it is fentanyl, but we don't know the source. We don't know the type. Chemically it's fentanyl, but we don't know where it came from. And really importantly, in talking with medical examiners and death investigators, they said, that's not just missing data, that's very suspicious. It's suspicious to not know the form of fentanyl. Because usually, fentanyl is used for very severe pain, and the family knows that and are under medical care and so on, and are most likely to be using patches. So it's weird if it's unknown. And a couple tidbits that came out of our report. The pattern of co-ingestant usage for those unknown fentanyls looks exactly like heroin users. They had a lot of stimulants and a lot of benzos. So just looking at the co-ingestant pattern, they looked really similar. In terms of the form, for those non-RX fentanyls, we had tablet and powder, and we had a lot of unknown. In all of this, I should say, most of our results were unknown. But I do this not because it's the magical answer, but to start the conversation and to encourage medical examiners to do a little bit more, for instance, just like we document probable heroin, they now also document pharmaceutical morphine. Doing both of those helps us dramatically. We can be doing the exact same thing for these fentanyl products. Those unknown fentanyls, if they said non-pharmaceutical fentanyl, that would give me a lot of information. I like that better than unknown. So this is kind of low-hanging fruit. So just wrapping up, kind of so what? So there's a lot of information out there. We're trying to understand what is going on, where, with whom, and what to do about it. I'm extremely heartened our health officers are really stepping up and are actually asking how they can help spread the word about treatment medications as a public health intervention. to change the understanding in the community that opiate use disorder is a treatable medical condition. Treatment medications support recovery and reduce mortality by 50%. It's one thing for a radical to say it. It's another thing for a health officer, who are all so respectable and not radical, to come in and say the same thing, and also really importantly to have the police chief saying the same thing. We're doing a lot of work with law enforcement to get them up to speed on this. And so, for instance, starting people on medications in jail and seeing that there's public health and public safety benefits. So we've demonstrated need and interest in these interventions, and we're really using it to drive supply and demand for these public health actions. I think we spent a lot of time trying to build capacity. We have to build demand for these actions as well, and that involves a lot of education, a lot of advocacy work, and it requires great data. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we'll now open this up for questions. Looks like we have a questioner right here.
Hi, Mike. Is this on? Yes. Hi, Michael Heumann from Oregon. Great presentations. Wonderful, astounding information. Not wonderful in terms of the direction of things. But I wonder if you could comment on something that wasn't really addressed, and that is the role of the pharmaceutical companies that are manufacturing not only the drugs or the chemicals, but the precursors for the street drugs. What do you see, and what would you like to see that could enter into this part of the equation? That seems to be missing from the discussion. The other stuff you addressed is really cool, but this seems like a huge, big elephant in the room.
Do you want me to start, and then you can do that? The less regulated answer. So what I would say is, I think when you look at how we got here, there's been a lot of articles and books written about the pharmaceutical industry and a lot of advertising, and we didn't have a lot of the data around how addictive these medications were, but yet they were being marketed for different needs. I think now, if you look at like what NIH is doing, really a focus on non-opioid medications and looking for different treatments for pain and focusing away from new opioid formulations, but looking for non-opioid formulations is something really impactful that the pharmaceutical industry will hopefully do.
Perfect.
Oh, look at that.
The answer is. I'll just keep talking. Yes, and you know, OxyContin was reformulated in the fall of 2010, and it had a really quite profound impact. We saw a tremendous and very quick impact in terms of the street availability, and in addition to these PDMPs, that actually probably pushed a lot of the shift to heroin. So we have to be careful how we do those regulatory responses. I also think related to that, I was thinking about this from an economic standpoint. So pharmaceutical companies have almost limited resources and theoretically a lot of rules. And heroin manufacturers and fentanyl manufacturers have essentially limitless resources and no rules. And so if you're trying to undermine that illicit market, that's actually where I go. And to me, how do you undermine that illicit market? We've tried to tamp down supply forever, and we'll continue to tamp down supply. But we have tools out there that could address demand and mortality tomorrow if we unleash them. So that's really where I tend to go. I mean, you're of course right. Many people are continuing to sue pharmaceutical manufacturers. There's going to continue to be a reining in of those products. The fundamental question I have is a different one, though, and that is, how do you undermine the illicit market? And to me, the way you do that is that you make Suboxone as available legally at every single pharmacy in the entire country, and that all the data systems are connected, and the Medicaid claims data are all connected. And if I can go get my coffee at any Starbucks, why can't a person with opiate use disorder get their treatment medication at any pharmacy? That's a decision that we could make as a country that could change what this epidemic looks like tomorrow. Somebody has to make that decision. I don't see that happening in our further and further. Well, maybe I'm wrong. Actually, with no regulations, we might be fine. We're fine.
Hi there. Thanks for your excellent presentations. Caleb, I think you made a provocative statement by asking, why do we take so much stuff? And I think part of the answer to that question, not all of it, is because it's cheap, readily available, and heavily advertised. And I think this gets somewhat at the point that was just made about the pharmaceutical industry, but it goes beyond that. And what I'm curious about is, you know, we have a big success story that we can point to with tobacco control, where tobacco took on all of those issues, price through tax policy, availability, and then certainly advertising and media advocacy as well. And I'm wondering if you could just maybe brainstorm with us a little bit about how you think some of those lessons learned might apply to the opioid epidemic. I mean, part of it obviously is controlling prescribing behavior. But what about the price side of the equation, for example? Is there something that we could do to make these drugs more expensive? I'm thinking about the synthetics, for example. Is there any way to intervene there using some of these kind of global strategies that we know have worked for other substances?
I mean, so on the prescribed side, I mean, that's the opposite direction everything is going in terms of, you know, prescription costs, right? So I think raising prescription costs, I'm not sure that's where we're going to get the yield. I think it really is trying to think about dropping costs in terms of increasing access to recovery medications. That really is where I see that shift happening. I just think, the role of FDA is very different in these medications and will become even more different, and probably less, there's going to be less regulatory burden to prove efficacy and effectiveness on these medications. There's so many new opioid tamper-resistant products in the pathway right now. I just would be surprised if that's going to be where we're going to really get a lot of yield. I just personally can't see that.
And I think, you know, when we've been looking at a lot of the studies that have been coming out, people have moved on to heroin because it was cheaper than prescription opioids. So if we raise the price of prescription opioids, it might encourage more people to seek illicit opioids, which is not what we want to happen. So I think finding ways to make non-opioid medications and non-pharmaceutical treatments more affordable and covered by insurance would be a step in the right direction. And then we're trying to do something that modeled after the smoking campaign, really around tips. And so we piloted in four states, and we hope to roll it out by the end of the summer, really a consumer-focused campaign on the risks of opioids, people that have experienced addiction or lost someone to overdose.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks. We all understand that the purpose for collecting data is to inform action, and one of the actions that gets bandied about often by governmental leaders is public warnings through the mass media, usually in response to what's thought to be an unusually high number of overdose deaths in an unexpectedly short period of time. You know, so we had X number of overdose deaths in this town over the weekend, or we had Y number of overdose deaths in this neighborhood in the past 24 hours, so you should do this. And, you know, often there's TV things, news conferences about warnings to people not to use their heroin. If you bought drugs in the past 48 hours, discard them. You know, the whole hot batch potency thing. What is your opinion, of both of you, about that as a tactic, as an intervention?
I'm all about getting information to people. I'm also very mindful that people of opioid use disorder are going to use opiates. We know that in Vancouver, their safe injection facility, they've been doing testing, and I think 70-80% of the heroin has fentanyl, and people use it. They have opioid addiction. They're going to use it. So I think it's trying to let them know what they're doing, and the point of the fentanyl piece that we did was really to try to identify the forms, particularly the bogus pills. Our sense is that people are not... they're not buying Roxycodone or Xanax on the street and knowing that it's fentanyl. Like, that's actually a useful piece of information I think I can give to people, is to be an informed consumer and then to do your harm reduction steps that you need to with your drugs. You know, we basically course the safest not to use. But when you use, use with other people, use less, have naloxone, know about a Good Samaritan law, call 911, and also understand that when you're ready, we have very effective treatment medications to support recovery and reduce mortality. So we always package it like that.
And the only thing I would add is it's helpful for providers, you know, working in the ER, if I give somebody a dose of naloxone and it doesn't work, knowing that somebody might need multiple doses because of this potent opioid that's out there is helpful, because you're not going to stop after that one dose. You're going to try a few more times, and that person may need to be admitted on a naloxone drip, so different treatments.
Okay.
And those meds are not going to come up on a regular screen in a hospital, yeah. So that's why it helps have that external information. And some hospitals are actually trying to add some of the new fentanyl analogs to their screens.
Hi. As an epidemiologist, I apologize for prefacing with anecdote, but I'm from the South, which is pretty much opioid addiction is our favorite pastime. And so in 2014, my mother was found dead at 46, and it was ruled natural causes by her physician, who was the doc in the box that had prescribed her 15-plus pain meds per day for the last 20 years before. And then in 2015, my stepfather died at 44 from complications of renal and cardiac failure as a result of long-term opioid abuse, but that was not mentioned in the death certificate as well. And then in 2016, my 29-year-old aunt died of what was ruled to be a suicide, but it was a cocktail of medicines where we're pretty sure she just wasn't explained that the opioids for her dental procedure would not work so well with all of her benzos and SSRIs. And so when there's an issue of potentially irresponsible prescription from a physician, where is the enforcement and the oversight to make sure that they are not covering up subsequent accidental or intentional overdoses on the death certificates and creating those data gaps that you mentioned?
Well, first, I'm saddened to hear about your family. I'm sorry to hear that. And you know, there isn't an easy answer to that. I mean, the short answer is the medical examiner notes it and reports to the authorities. You don't have the time to. The police don't have time to do investigations of acetyl fentanyl deaths, right? So to investigate a death that looks easy because it's a natural, I mean, the resources aren't there. I mean, I think that is a place where, that is where prescription monitoring program data do start to have added values when you do mortality linkages with them. That's when I think you start actually getting some real meaning out of those PMP data. And then you can have state medical boards actually responding to that. So that's where I would start to think maybe more effective there than actually sort of that short-term law enforcement at the ground level, but more state regulatory responses. And again, I think that's where there's added value for prescription monitoring program.
Hi, my name is Tish Davis, and I direct the Occupational Health Program in Massachusetts. So I really want to raise the issue of increased collaboration between your community and the occupational health communities. And I think there are a lot of opportunities. In our state, our local coalitions that are dealing with drug abuse are coming to us and saying, we're seeing a lot of blue-collar workers, we're seeing construction workers. We can actually look at this in our death data. We're doing that right now. You can look at patterns of opioid deaths by industry and occupation using your death certificates, collaborating with your NVDRS. And what we also see is, and you can, tremendous interest in the labor community in dealing with this, and trade associations. We've got some model peer-to-peer counseling of operating engineers. So I really think you can use your data to identify high-risk groups and use those communities for outreach. But the real issue I want to raise, and I was glad to hear you mention Gary Franklin, we need better understanding of work-related injuries as a gateway to opioid use. And that's hard research to do, but there's some real opportunities to do it. So I would really encourage thinking about that. And then, of course, ultimately, assuming that work-related injuries do contribute substantially is primary prevention, and to not simply accept those injuries as part of the job. So this isn't really a question. I'm on my soapbox, but I think there's tremendous opportunities for collaboration. There's policy issues with respect to workers' comp in your state. Maybe you could comment on some of those. I know Washington State, there's probably been more collaboration than in most. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that.
And I would just follow up with that. We need to wrap up.
No, I was just going to say it's almost 10 o'clock. The poster session starts now. It'll go for a half hour. So we will go until 5 after 10. So there's probably going to be time for one more question. But if you want to go catch the beginning of the poster session, feel free to leave now. Thank you.
Let me just respond to that real quickly, and maybe we'll take another question. The occupational health piece of this has been very, very important. A related piece that we're just finally starting to do, as I said, we've been really focused on tamping down supply. But a physician with a patient, that's a dyad that's very difficult, you know, to just be restrictive and feel punitive. What we're excited about is actually trying to build a demand, and this a decreased demand, and this actually came out of an ER doc who was on our King County Heroin Task Force, basically saying, could we shift the conversation around opiates like we have around antibiotics? how do we shift the conversation that it's not a win to leave with this medication in your hand? And we now have some really nice, I'm very excited about them, educational flyers that basically say, if you have acute pain that's going to go in away in a week or two, you shouldn't take opiates. You shouldn't take opiates. If you do take them, you should take the smallest supply possible. You should lock them up. And the day you stop using them, get rid of them. So really trying to shift that conversation and really change the culture.
Hi, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and I work within the EPI division. And Ohio currently leads the nation in opioid overdose deaths. And something that we've been thinking about is looking at predictive algorithms in order to help determine where we think opioid overdose deaths will occur. And I wanted to know if that has been explored in other states throughout the U.S., as well as the feasibility of that. So looking at data from multiple sources to help build that predictive algorithm. I know that it's been used in law enforcement quite a bit to predict crime in specific areas. So I'm just wondering if you have any feedback in relation to that.
And mentioning law enforcement is the perfect segue into what I was going to say about is we actually initiated a personnel swap with DEA to where we have somebody so we can access the NIFLIS data, and we've looked at drug seizures, and we find that drug seizures is very much associated with drug overdoses, and so you can start looking at where you're having high rates of seizure, fentanyl, and some other illicit opioids, and know that you'll likely have high rates of overdoses there. And then with the surveillance system that we are developing, you know, with syndromic surveillance, we're hoping to, and with the NBDRS, to really identify whether it's communities or predictors of individuals who are likely to overdose. That way we can really improve treatment. I think, you know, at CDC we had been having efforts. I think this goes to the mention of occupational health. We now have actually one point person in my center who is coordinating all of our agency work because we know that there's maternal morbidity, there's NAS, there's occupational issues, there's surveillance issues. So we're really focused on having a coordinated approach to this now. And so part of this will be better surveillance data and algorithms, like you mentioned, from law enforcement and others.
And I just would say that I, two things on that. I think those examples make good sense. One thing that I see that is concerning to me around PMP data and all sorts of algorithms is we get very distracted by relative risk and don't look at absolute risk. And you're not going to get a lot of bang for your buck because, yeah, the people at the highest doses have the highest risk, but they're very, very rare. The vast majority of people are getting low doses and dying on those, usually because of benzos and alcohol. So just always really trying to be mindful of how we're interpreting those data. And then the point is, well, so what? What do you do? I've been having some lovely coffee talks with our health officer. He's like, oh, well, we've got to be on the lookout for fentanyl. When's it going to come? What are we going to do? I'm like, we're doing that. But it's also like, well, what we would do is what we could be doing now, which is making low barrier access to treatment medications. I mean, so it's also trying to think about, yes, I know we love to count stuff. We need surveillance. I hope that those surveillance data will ultimately be intervention effect data when we also start putting these tools in. Because the cool thing about this issue is we have the tools to fix them if we decide to deploy them. That's the issue. We have the tools. So when we hear things about maybe presidential commissions that are wondering what we should do, we've known what to do for 15 years. It's just making the decision to actually unleash that and to sort of break up sort of the bureaucracy we have and just deploy the tools we have, which could be a public health response if public health chose to do that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much to our speakers.